I'm Elena Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind. Hi, it's Ilana. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. And today I have a profound pleasure and personal joy to bring to you a conversation with an old dear friend and mentor of mine. Professor Achola Pala Okeo is an anthropologist, a researcher, a writer, and educator. She has a PhD in anthropology, a master's degree in education from Harvard. Her undergraduate degree in literature and sociology comes from the University of East Africa in Tanzania. An acclaimed public speaker, she's traveled extensively within Africa and across the world and addressed academic, policy, cultural, and civil society forums. And locally in Kenya, she mentors young people and women in arts, culture, and heritage. I know Achola from our work together at UNIFEM, where she was the chief of the Africa desk, but Achola has hugely extensive work experience within the United Nations system that's brought her in close contact with African governments, regional and global development bodies, bringing policy, politicking, academia, all into a particularly potent integration of understanding and analysis and action. Achola has long been a champion of women and girls' rights and is a passionate advocate for a positive outlook on Africa's development founded on the continent's natural resources, rich culture, and art history. She supports strategies to harness Africa's tremendous human and productive capacities and potential to address urgent problems while strengthening our global engagement in knowledge building and wealth creation. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
It's such a pleasure to have you here, Achola, and to be able to speak to you. I know that you're in Kenya today as we speak to you, and it's just lovely to have you on Grandmothers on the Move podcast.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So, Achola, there's so many things that I hope we will talk about today.
Yeah.
We're living in such challenging and turbulent times. I have many questions, but I wanted to start by asking you, what is it that's on your mind right now? What are you thinking about? How are you experiencing this extraordinary moment that we're living in?
You know, two main things, Alana. Here we have the COVID-19 threat. So we shut down in March, but the information, it was not clear what the infection rates were. And then after some time, we started to see small numbers when we were seeing huge numbers in New York and Italy. Because it was kind of the opposite of what people thought might happen in Africa. It looks as if the onset is late, and now our numbers are going up and up.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're almost 10,000 now. And the main concern really now is a lot of this spiking is going on in Nairobi and Mombasa. And the rest of the country, either for lack of testing or the reality is that we're not seeing big numbers in the rest of the country. So now the worry, of course, is if Nairobi opens up, which everybody seems to be baying for, then the threat for other parts of the country is very real. And I'm worried because we don't have the preparedness to handle any kind of large numbers of disaster like that. So that's kind of a big challenge that I worry about. The other is the chaos and the horrific things that happened in America, especially the killing of George Floyd and several other African Americans. That was very hard to take because it was happening on television and we could see it in real time. And that really brought up a lot of angst. I have my children in the States, so I was very worried and angry and upset. At the same time, the response globally was just unbelievable. It was amazing to me that virtually every part of the world was horrified and they expressed their anger and their solidarity with the Black folk in America. So that was like a new chapter in the global outlook on an issue that had been muted for some time. it was more American, and then suddenly it became global. And that was stunning, to say the least. And I was happy to see that all people of conscience were looking at this issue, were responding. So those are things that are upsetting. You know, the COVID thing is a problem because sudden pressure on the economy and sudden isolation of people and families are in trouble and a lot of confusion. People are not sure exactly what to expect.
Yeah, it's tough.
Mm-hmm. At the household level, we're seeing increases in gender-based violence, which is a very big concern because we're seeing trauma rises in suicide among young people, and it's a worrying trend. Young people are particularly traumatized because many of our young people, their livelihoods are based on almost a day-to-day informal economy. They have to go out every day and make a few shillings, spend that on food and other supplies, and then go out again the next day. So if that shuts down as it has, it puts people in an enormous pressure. The housing situation gets tight, especially in the cities. In the poor urban areas, housing is very tight because normally, again, with this daily economy, people go out, children go to school. So most people go out and do their work out of the house. And it's a little space that you come back to cook dinner and sleep. But now if you're there all day and all night and on top of each other, that's really a worry.
Yeah, there's no question. I think globally, one of the things that's happened with the pandemic is really showing the lack of sustainable support for people's lives becomes like a vector of danger for the family and for women in particular and for people who are living on the margins. Everything from housing to food security suddenly is even more dangerous, is even more precarious.
Yeah. On the eve of the pandemic, as it fell on us, the county government of Kisumu invited me and another young lady to try to develop a response program. And that's what we're working on now. Something that can be put on the ground that can help communities to respond effectively, at least to protect themselves, grow food and look after their health and well-being. We also have had floods, so we've been dealing with multiple and complex disasters.
And in terms of the response, what do you think is needed? What would actually make a difference in the ability for communities to maintain their resilience and to manage the challenges that are going to come with this kind of pandemic?
Before the pandemic, the trade between Kisumu County and other counties was quite active, and they were importing a lot of food from other counties, including Uganda and Tanzania. And when those borders closed, then the food supply just went down. So now we've seen the shortages, but we also see that there's land that could be tilled and people could grow their own food and at least be self-sustaining. The other line of action is creating great involvement of communities in county policy and programs, the flow of resources, to participate in the devolved governance.
I'm just wondering, because I know that this is an area of expertise of yours, what does that mean around the really considerable work that's been done around women's rights and gender equality?
My observation has been that there's been what one might call a real disjunction between what's on the page and actualization of these rights. And that's been a big challenge, and I think it's become more so because even though the work has been done, you see less and less evidence of actual application of these improved rights. You do not see enough on the ground in terms of what has been achieved. So one of the things that I fear, I'm just expressing my own views because this is what I've been observing. First of all, the country curtailed the number of NGOs that were working in these fields. But after that curtailment, you see that NGOs are working almost also like government. They're sort of on their own, doing small things here and there. But the movement spirit has died, as far as I can see. So you don't see that upsurge of people demanding their rights on a sustained basis, as we were working on the women's movement, you remember? You know, Sarah Longue talked about something called the evaporation of policy. Now you almost feel there's an evaporation of progress that has been made, and we're in the stage in which you do not see a sufficient number of responses given the knowledge that people have and actions that have already been taken, the activism. The other thing that has become somewhat clear is that women who've taken positions of leadership were not movement people. So you see some sporadic actions when something really, really bad happens and some women will go out. But you really feel that women's leadership has been sabotaged somewhat by a classist mentality.
And what do you attribute all of this to, Wichola? I mean, that's really significant. Kenya's always had a powerful NGO movement, particularly around women's rights. There was so much dynamism.
I don't know. I have been very surprised, really. You know, there are two kinds of things that are happening among women. One is that a very large number of the women who got elected in these either decentralized governments, they're called the county assemblies, or national parliament, or the Senate. You don't have a debate on equality between men and women the way you used to have it. You would have women in parliament talking, women going out and speaking. You see more of a class of new arrivals on the scene. These leaders were now in position, and you do not see a sufficient concern with the constituency that they're supposed to serve.
And at the same time, at the grassroots level, there are these women leaders, a lot of them are older women, who are really holding their communities together, but who are not afforded the opportunity or are not connected to the national level. That advocacy stays at community level.
Right. And that's where I think that for our program, we would like to see a greater connection between those women who are working at the grassroots level and who are conscious about change that they want, but they are truncated from public policy, that if they could connect amongst themselves across the wards in the villages and connect to local government and see that they can make demands on the local government, given the analysis that they've made of the situation in which they live. If that connection can come, then we can expect to see an awakening, if you like, of a larger number of people to the fact that there's analysis and there are things to be done and they need to get involved.
You know, Achola, as you're speaking, I have a question. I wonder what you think. There was a time when the donor community was much more supportive of and funding movement building, advocacy, convenings, meetings, allowing women to come together at all levels. It was policy, it was political participation, it was legal advocacy, and that certainly has diminished. And of course, movements and the struggle for human rights and women's rights has never needed to be funded to exist. But a lot of the work that was done at a certain time when you and I were working together, there was much more money flowing for that kind of work. Mm. And then I think I saw a conservative trend of pulling back on that kind of support. What do you think about that? Has that played a role?
Yes, I would agree with you. You know, there was a time that donors were very forthcoming in terms of seeing this organized movement as a way to make change happen. And they were therefore much more forthcoming. But now those movements are really struggling. And as I say, many NGOs, many CSOs that were doing this work are not necessarily being funded to do this work. The media advocacy that's needed, there's a certain conservatism that has set in. And I'm wondering what has cost it. Globally, I think when global recession has pushed more developed countries to keep their money at home or send their own people to follow the money. But I think the trend has been on both sides. Here, for example, in our country, you don't see government engagement with women's groups and women's organizations, women's movement. You know, you don't see that active engagement at any level, really. And therefore, you do not see donors also engaging. you know, those donor roundtables that we used to be able to get, and donors coming specifically to support work on AIDS and support work on community resilience. We're just not seeing enough of that funding. And so you find that there's a tremendous amount of isolation, I would say, of grassroots women leaders who were doing important work, but who were also getting program funding from donors. And now they're somewhat isolated. Something has been lost. Women have to continue to organize, I think, and use the analysis, because the analysis is there, but it's evaporating because it's not being used enough. And perhaps also something has happened in the rise in social media and the use of technology in communicating development that has left a number of ordinary people and groups somewhat behind. Because consider, you and I have been trying to meet on this technology for a while.
That's true.
And where I live in the countryside, I do not have the equipment. And even if you go to the cyber cafe, there isn't enough, apart from sending your emails, there's not enough platforms and inexpensive places where you can go and meet. And so you're finding that technology is also facilitating a certain class, but it's really separating the poor from the better off.
And I remember having wonderful conversations with you about this many years ago, when the international community and the multilaterals, bilaterals started focusing much more on results, what they considered to be the kinds of results that they wanted to see. And part of what has disturbed me deeply is during COVID, I think we, all of us globally, are seeing similar devastating impacts of neoliberalism, colonialism, which I think this sort of results, goal-oriented efficiency, almost a sort of businessy type model that got introduced. I know Florence Puttegla was talking about this when I was speaking with her, and it really struck me, because some of what that did was to interrupt the support and the movement building around systemic change. And now we're in these crises, and we see that the systems that support everything from discrimination to inequality to lack of access to resources, to health, to technology, to food security, that these systems have continued, and the resources to dismantle them have been curtailed.
No, I would agree. You know, I did an article in 2011-ish there about what I call the ground we stand on. It was published by Women's Media Center in New York. We had been to Zimbabwe with Mary Robinson as the leader of delegation at a time when Zimbabwe was working on its new constitution, and she mobilized women of various levels of knowledge and activism to go and work in solidarity with the women of Zimbabwe. And we went there and we spoke and we talked with various cross-section of women. And when I came back from that trip is when it struck me that systemic change is really, really needed. The structures of governance, if you like, were still very colonial and very much based on class relations, and more supportive of an elitist framework that really didn't allow ordinary people to participate and benefit from development any more than they were doing earlier. So what I was trying to argue was that this routinization of the women's movement, if you like, the routinization of people's movements, caused us to lose the focus, because it sort of became just like one other thing. And then this results movement that you're talking about, this, the whole idea of results, 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 shifted the discourse from questioning or analyzing relationships of what causes people to remain poor. So there's no question, in a way, of what type of results, where are they coming from, who's driving results, and results for what. To see how the documents that we worked on very hard, like the Beijing Platform for Action and previous documents and, you know, the human rights ones and so on, we have all these instruments, but the change that we were expecting has not necessarily occurred. And I think it's very much this complacency that has set in, that as long as you're producing some sort of result, that it is okay. Not all results are okay. and results must emanate from analysis, you know. And this whole sort of long framing of development and results and that sort of debate created a certain complacency, if you like. Our work is not done yet. Definitely, one needs to reflect about philanthropy in terms of what direction could it take in order to make a change for women. Once we finish the analysis, then we now have to take that analysis and turn it into some action. And keep coming back. You see how the civil rights movement has lost momentum for a while, because we thought that, yes, the movement had made it possible for laws to change. Certain quotas had been won, and so on. And then out of nowhere, things were growing, and still a black man can be killed on the street like a dog.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of have to continue to come back and let people not rest, because the assumption that, well, we've done it, we haven't done it. We have to do and redo and do and do and continue to do. People must not tire. This is really what I see. I'm getting older a bit, but you see, I'm now really prepared to go back on the streets.
Right.
And go back to the countryside and say, wake up, guys. It's not over yet. We haven't done it yet. We've got the analysis, but everything is routinized. And then people forget the connection between work that has been done over decades. The connection between that analysis and action and resources is just lost, really, as far as you can see. And that's why you continue to need people of goodwill to come back and get champions and get women to champion, to continue the advocacy and to be present and to be visible in the change that we need. Because there's been a hiatus, in my view, between the generations in terms of movement analysis and the movement work that was done some decades back, which in a way has created the platform for younger women to be freer. But they're forgetting that freedom came as a result of a movement, as a result of some desire for change, and that people were working on these things, and the next generation and the next and the next must work on these things in order to sustain the momentum. The work is not done yet.
And that's one of the reasons that I've been so determined to speak to grandmothers and older women, however older women identify in the work that they're doing, because I think that partly it's continuity, but partly I feel an urgency not to lose the history and the analysis that older women contributed and still need to contribute now. This isn't a history lesson.
It's a living history,
mm-hmm.
a living story. I agree with you. I think that even I feel that we slept for a minute because we thought, well, you know, we did what we could. Energies were going down a bit. So we thought, well, you know, we've said it, we've written it, proclaimed it, we put it in law. But the really treacherous thing, Alana, is the ideological change that has happened in the last 20 years. It's been creeping up on us. But the assumption that once wealth has been created, everybody has access to it. I call it this routinization of thought, that people just assume that, okay, we did it before. We know it. You know, so we put it aside. We know it. Don't tell us again because we've already known it. Not thinking that same knowledge that we have, that we analyze, that we put forth, still must be revamped and utilized. And really, I don't think there's anything that replaces people rising up, people getting together and saying, we want change. And people must be ready to sustain that change across generations. And this is what I think we've lost a little bit.
Yeah. And what you're saying resonates in this historic moment deeply. It sounds very similar to what you're saying now about how you have to be vigilant about these struggles for human rights and equality.
Mm-hmm. I had not, after all these years in the States and being very much aware of the racial tensions, you know, we worked around issues of race here in my country under apartheid and then in the US and historically. But the thing that struck me when that young man was killed was the shock and the anger. I have often been upset, but this time I was really angry. Angry about the fact that just because of the color of your skin, and there's a lot under the color of the skin, the class, the privilege and that sort of thing. But to be bearing witness in my old age to the same thing that I saw as a younger person on racial discrimination, and that we really haven't made progress, that is what really made me very upset. Because I know when I arrived in the States in 1970, the fellow was coming to cut my hair in my dorm on 6 Ash Street. And this was a graduate women's dorm, so we were all supposedly mature women. And this guy shows up at the door, and the reception, who was just one of our students, would not let him in. Opens the door and slams it on his face and calls the police. And his name was Lloyd. Curious coincidence. Lloyd stood at the door. It was a snowy early winter, and he stood out there, and then he called me and he said, you know, Achola, I'm here at the door, and somebody opened and slammed the door on my face. So I came downstairs immediately, and I said, this guy was coming to see me. And she said, oh, and then she opened the door. And because I was new to this, I had not quite internalized the nature of that exchange. And then the woman who was a warden, I think they're called wardens of the dorms, the incident was reported to her. And then in the morning, she put up a notice and said, if you see a stranger, call the police and say a black man is at the door. That was a stunner. And the women, the black women who were in my building, because I was just learning about this whole depth of this racial thing in the States, were extremely upset, and they went up to her and demanded that that notice be taken down, and they went and reported it to the dean. Mm-hmm. Much later, I was in a building, a very nice building in Riverdale. I'm working at the UN, and we're both living on this floor, the upper floor, with this same woman. She lives at one end, and I'm at the other end, and she obviously must not have been seeing me taking that elevator, or maybe she was thinking I was working for someone else. So I go downstairs to the basement to do my laundry, and she approaches me and says, do you have any hours? I need someone to work for me. I think I did not really fully understand what she was talking about. I don't think we come from that racial attitude. I think in the States, the issues are very different. But from Africa, we don't usually assume that when you see someone who's white or black, you don't come with a huge bag of assumptions. But here she says to me, do you have some hours? And I'm like, what do you mean? I need somebody to work for me too. Upon which she just kind of walked away quietly, and I kept on washing my thing. That is what is so bad about racism. Mm-hmm. The assumption that you could only be in a certain groveling class, that you could not be a different person outside of your skin, that is a stunner. Because no matter what you do, at that time I had a Harvard PhD. I'm working at the UN. I'm head of Africa desk. I have been an ambassador's wife and everything the class would offer you.
Right.
And I'm still being asked, do you have time? Because she assumed that because I was there in the basement washing my things, I must have been working for someone else. That really blew my mind. Now we see this young man being killed,
right, in
broad daylight. There's just no way to describe this thing, Alana. Because when you think we were movement people around apartheid and the horrors of apartheid, and you thought, okay, that was a special situation. But it's really not that special. It's the attitude. And that's what needs to change. If people could see deeper into the humanity of each other and just understand that we're the same, it's just literally skin deep. But that skin deep now conjures up so many other things, so many other problems, that you just cannot see beyond that skin. How do you tell the difference between people then? Where is the interest in knowing a thing or two about this person who you see washing their clothes in the basement with you? Or do you see standing in front of the train, waiting to board the train? Where is the curiosity? How do you get to know this person if you don't ask them anything? Therein lies the problem.
Mm-hmm.
People will have to change. But I think what we have seen in the movement, in the spontaneous uprising across the world when these killings happened, it gives hope. And if that were the beginning of a new shift to be very good, that I don't know if we can sustain it.
Yeah, and it takes so much out of people.
It takes a lot out of people. But I truly think what it will need is an intergenerational effort. It is not the work of one generation and then it's done. It's never done. We just have to keep at it. The grandmothers have done their bit. Now the children have done their bit. The grandchildren still have to do their bit. And the great-grandchildren still have to do their bit. Because the moment you close your eye, the thing comes right back at you. I find that curtailment of one's freedom, the sad thing for me is that very deep, ingrained curtailment of another person's freedom, even before you talk to them and have a chance to know what they're about. That's a big loss of opportunity. Here in Kenya, you know, when I was growing up, we have a tradition of asking a few preliminary questions when you meet someone so that you'll get a little bit of a sense of who they are and where they come from and what they're doing before you make any assumption. And we still have it. It'll go like this. I would not know your name. I'd say, hello, young lady. And you'd say, hello, mama. And then I'd say, you've come to visit in this neighborhood? And you'd say, no, I'm not visiting. I'm just passing through to visit an aunt, and then I'm going back home. And then I would say, but where's home? And then you'd tell me, my home is in Kisumu. And I said, oh, I see. And then I might say, do you work in Kisumu, or what do you do there? So we have a preliminary conversation, which enables me to know you enough to not make too many assumptions about who you are. And to me, I think it's such a great tradition because it allows you to see the humanity of the person that you meet. Then they have a chance to tell you something of who they are. And then you might say, I'm a visiting student at this university and I've come to visit this family. Straight away, I can put you in a comfortable zone that will enable me to get to know you as a person more than as a person of color or as a white person. But I noticed that in the States when I was there, people are very careful about talking and chatting. People don't want to ask you questions. The familiarity is a little challenging. So people would prefer not to talk. At the same time, they still have these assumptions, you see. So they have to speak up. But it's an ongoing effort, whether it's discrimination against women, whether it's discrimination against Black folk, whether it's discrimination against Native Americans, this sort of blanket, lazy way of just saying, oh, you know, those people, has to stop. And people have to continue to be reminded that that's just not on. So I think even grassroots communities must not just say, oh, you know, that's government. Government is difficult. They have to engage. People must engage.
You know, when you think about so much hard work being done by Black people, by Black Lives Matter, movement building, mobilizing, by Indigenous people, by people of color, there's so much hard work being done. There's yet another iteration of the revolution to be fought and won. And I wonder, Achola, as somebody who was involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, who was involved in civil rights work in the United States, was in the U.S. during that time, who has certainly brought to the fore, I remember well, even when we worked together, issues around disparities which are North-South, but also for Black women within the movement and the women's rights movement. You know, what would you say now to the younger people who are very much on the front lines of this new necessary moment of uprising? And how do you integrate what you bring? Because I think, obviously, it's urgently needed.
It's hard because I think that young people, especially now people who are in their 20s, 30s, they have come of age when things have been relatively opened up. And I was talking to my son the other day, my big son, Odhiambo. We were discussing this whole climate of protest right now. And he said to me that he was glad that as his mother, I always expressed to them this whole issue in an interesting way. I did not start off from the position that because you're Black, you will be prevented from enjoying 1, 2, 3. You see, because when you're growing up children, they must not be given the idea that they cannot go places, that there are certain limits because of their color. It's a very risky thing. You can't afford to tell them to be conservative because they're Black. At the same time, you have to be able to express to them the dangers that are out there, or what other people perceive of you. So I said to them that I'm always starting from the position that I have a right to be everywhere, and my children have a right to be everywhere. They should not feel that they are stopped by their own color. But having said that, we as parents, I am now looking at myself as an older person, must create in the minds of children a pathway to freedom, so that when they grow up, they know that there's a path to freedom, that they can walk it. And even though it is difficult, they should feel bold enough to walk as free people and not as people in bondage. My son is almost 40 now, and we were having this conversation the other day during the very difficult period before Floyd was buried. And he said to me that, "I'm really glad that you taught us this ethos of not feeling afraid because of who we are, or not feeling stopped because of who we are, but forging ahead and being the example of what you want people to understand the Black person to be." That is a very difficult job, but it has to be done by parents and by groups. And when kids are in college, when they gather as Black people, they should not gather from an inward looking, from an isolationist point of view. They're gathering because they want to articulate what they think that Black person can contribute, what that Black person is, what that Black person means to society, how that, in other words, they have to be redefining that identity and finding the place for Black people to walk. If you don't do that, then the children are growing up with a feeling that there are places they cannot go because they're Black. Anticipating discrimination before it hits you. I don't anticipate discrimination, you know that. That's how I was living in the States. And when I was looking for housing, for example, I would go to a neighborhood that I wanted to live in, and nobody was going to start by telling me you can't live here. That I was not accepting. So when I would choose a realtor to help me to find a house, it would tend to be also a realtor who was willing to show me good houses. But sometimes you would find a realtor and they'll show you a house that's not so good. They take you to a good neighborhood, but they show you the dregs, some houses falling apart or something, you know, something that's just not pleasant, because they were afraid that if they took you to the center of the village, that the neighbors might say, "Oh, you know, can't give you more work because you're bringing us all these Black people." So whenever they took me to see houses, my first conversation in the car was, "You know, I like comfort." "I'd like you to show me a really nice house because I don't like to live badly." So that was my spiel in the car all the time.
Did it work?
It did work, because I got good housing. Sometimes I got discriminated by the neighbors, but I did get good housing because I always said I wanted to live well. But I also didn't want to give them a chance to think that that's what I deserved or that what I would accept because of the situation. I just refused to accept discrimination. It happened, but only now are we having this conversation with my son. As he said, "You know, in growing up, even though we grew up here in a place where, because you're Black, nobody really gave you a chance to be diverse within that color or to show diversity of experience, your philosophy of life was very helpful and has really been helpful to me," and he's telling me, "so that when I go about my business, I'm not seeing immediate boundaries and blockages. I'm seeing pathways for me to pass. Let somebody stop me, that's their business. But I'm not going to stop myself from the good life just because I think that somebody thinks that I don't deserve it." You see where I'm coming from?
Yes.
And that's a subtle lesson that I think parents need to teach, especially parents of Black folk. That's what I'm hoping, that when these young people are gathering together in Black Lives Matter campaign, I would like young people to go from a position of strength. Go forth knowing that you deserve something, that you're somebody. Don't go forth thinking you're nobody because somebody has tried to define you that way. You have to reject discriminatory definitions. And that's how my mother brought me up as a woman. We were always taught to be leaders, and we never thought that we would be considered women and therefore not deserving of leadership or not deserving to be in places where men were. We just didn't have that concept.
Right. And for the women your age, Achola, for the elders and the elder stateswomen like you and the grandmother activists, what do you say to them?
I think we have to continue to teach. Even I've been in a bit of a lull. And 2 days ago, I was talking to a couple of young people with whom we're working in this program. And I was telling them that I think they were a bit surprised when I came to chair the meeting the first day I was elected chair of the COVID response committee. And when I chaired that first meeting, I got the feedback from 3 or 4 young people. They came to me and they said, "You really chaired that meeting very well." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You were moderate, you were firm, you controlled the meeting." And I think because of my age and because I'm a woman, they thought that I might not be quite as competent as a man in my position. So I said to them, you know, this is how we were trained. If you're chairing a meeting, you're not fooling around. You're controlling the meeting. You're letting people speak. You're not supposed to talk too much. You're supposed to moderate. But you must also temper people and not let one person run away with a discussion. And then they were very surprised. But I said to them, you know, this is how you're going to have to learn leadership. And I think all the young people need to be told that they should be their best. In our generation, it's a bit difficult because you have to say, when I was growing up, when you were growing up, it's all very good. But now these young people are growing up now. So we have to apply what we knew to the present and see how young people can benefit from our knowledge and experience.
Well, which we all do. It's a perfect note to end on, because now all of us who listen will also have the benefit of this knowledge. And I can't thank you enough. What people won't know is how late at night it is for you and how hard we had to work to come together.
I'm just delighted that you are very tenacious, and it's been wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much for this. It was not just wonderful, but deeply meaningful to hear your insights.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ilana Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com and come back next week for another episode.